You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
You know, you don't have to look very far from this auditorium to see evidence of what Joseph Stiglitz calls the Great Divide. Tonight, just a few blocks from here, there are American citizens, as we all know, sleeping on the sidewalks under cardboard, if they're lucky. So how has America become the most unequal advanced country in the world, and what can we do about it? That's the question that economist Joseph E. Stiglitz ponders and diagnoses in his new book, The Great Divide. Blending clarity and passion, Stiglitz argues that inequality is a choice, the cumulative result of unjust policies and misguided priorities. His is a call to confront America's economic inequality as the political and moral issue that it is. In the last 15 years, Joseph Stiglitz has written a series of highly popular books that have had an enormous influence in shaping global debates. His 2002 book, Globalization and Its Discontents, was translated into 35 languages, and it laid bare the way globalization had been managed, especially by the international financial institutions. His other recent books are The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society Endangers Our Future, and Creating a Learning Society, A New Approach to Growth, Development, and Social Progress. And his new book, The Great Divide, which he'll discuss tonight, gathers his writings from popular outlets like Vanity Fair and The New York Times. And in this book, he exposes the dimensions as well as the causes and consequences of America's inequality. In 2001, Joseph Stiglitz was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his analyses of markets with asymmetric information. I cannot explain to you what that is. And he was a lead author of the 1995 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. In 2011, Time named Joseph Stiglitz one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and there are lucky students at Columbia who get to study with him where he is university professor. And Jim Newton tonight, Professor Stiglitz's interlocutor, is himself a great journalist and author, and as well a great friend of the Library Foundation. He spent 25 years as a reporter, bureau chief, columnist, and editor at the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of two critically acclaimed biographies, Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made, and Eisenhower, The White House Years. And last year, he collaborated with former CIA director and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta on his autobiography, Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace. And he's presently creating a new magazine at UCLA, which will debut in the spring. So onwards to the conversation. Please join me in welcoming Jim Newton and Joseph Stiglitz. Thank you.
Well, thank you all. It's always a pleasure to be here at Aloud, and a special treat tonight to be here with Joseph Stiglitz. He and I have appeared on the stage together before, and I can promise you he is as engaging a speaker as he is a writer. As Luis said, his new book is The Great Divide, Unequal Societies and What We Can Do About Them. It's largely built around his incisive and sometimes prescient columns and op-ed pieces chronicling America's Great Recession. It's an extraordinary collection and a bracing, provocative book, and we'll get to it in just a moment. First, a quick rundown on the plan for the evening, which Louise alluded to. The two of us are going to talk for 40, 45 minutes, then we'll open it up to you for your questions, so be ready. One favor to ask of you, when it comes your turn, please ask a question. I know how tempting it is to lecture a Nobel laureate, but most of us are here to hear him, so please. Okay. So to begin, at the risk of starting with sort of a smart alecky question, why is inequality bad? I mean, we don't have complete equality, right? You have a Nobel Prize and I don't, sure that'll be changing someday. But we accept certain kinds of inequality in society. So what's the beef?
Well, I mean, some people don't think it's bad. The Wall Street Journal wrote a review of my book, and I think their complaint. They complained about my complaining about inequality. They thought there was too little, and I obviously thought there's too much. Inequality. No society is going to have complete equality, so that's not what the issue here. It's the extremes of inequality that America has attained. You know, there's a view of American exceptionalism, and we are exceptional. We have more inequality and less equality of opportunity than other advanced countries. And I think, as I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later, it actually undermines our society, it undermines our democracy. And as an economist, I actually think it's also bad for our economy.
And I do want to get back to some of the specifics, but just to sort of complete that point, is there a motivational benefit to inequality economically in the sense that it causes people to aspire to found a Walmart or to save money or to, in addition to the downsides of inequality, are there benefits economically?
I don't think it's the inequality that motivates people. Obviously, some people find it's very important to have a return for their effort, absolutely. Much of the inequality in the United States has nothing to do with that. The notion that if the notion that inequality was a result of people making huge contributions to our society, then the theory that's called trickle-down economics would be true. That is to say, as they got richer, everybody else would benefit. But when you look at inequality in the United States today, what you see is there hasn't been trickle-down economics. The top have done very, very well, but incomes in the middle just have stagnated for a quarter century.
Right. How do we measure this inequality? And by those measures, what is it that you're looking for that you're finding this evidence of broadening inequality?
There's no single measure, and we look at a number of different things. A standard measure is called the Gini coefficient. That's a technical thing that increased the United States now to a very, very high level. Of the kind a number that's comparable to a lot of the countries that we would not want to be associated with. But the other dimensions of inequality are, you know, what percentage of the total income goes to the top 1%, which in the United States is between 20 and 25%. And that's in terms of income, twice the number that it was just 35 years ago. Another measure is what fraction of the population is in poverty. That number has also increased. And then a third dimension that we often talk about is the hollowing out of the middle. What's happening to the middle? And that's the point I made about stagnation in the middle. The number of people that are within a given band of the middle is declining. You look at various demographic groups. The income of a typical American male worker, for instance, full-time male worker, is lower than it was 40 years ago.
Adjusted for inflation.
Adjusted for inflation, right. Yes.
And yet, one thing I was quite surprised to note in your book, looking at this sort of 20-year period, 88 to 2008, which you use in a couple of places, that while inequality was soaring in many countries in those years, there are a few countries where it was actually declining, right? You mentioned Mexico, Chile, Turkey, Hungary. What are those countries doing differently that's allowing them to produce a different result than we're experiencing?
Well, I mean, the point you raise is a really important one, that while the economic forces are largely global, changes in technology, globalization, the way they play out in terms of inequality are markedly different. And that's the sense in which the United States now has the most inequality of the advanced countries. To me, it's mostly about policies. And countries that have consciously taken policies to reduce that inequality have succeeded. I mean, an example is, for instance, Brazil. It's a developing country, but emerging market. But about 20 years ago, there was a bipartisan consensus, the center-left and the center-right, that inequality had gotten out of hand and was going to destroy their society. So first, under center-right government, Henrique Cardoso, they implemented very strong policies of education to try to bring education to everybody. And then under President Lula, they focused on health, nutrition, a whole set of other things, particularly focusing on the very poor, some very innovative programs. And the amazing thing is, in 20 years, you can really see inequality falling. You know, usually it takes a long, long time before it starts showing up in the macroeconomic data. In the case of Brazil, it's already showing up.
Oh, wow. And those are policies enacted just 20 years ago.
That's right.
In the last 20 years.
25 years ago. Yeah.
Another thing you talk about a lot in the book is the work of Thomas Piketty and his Capital in the 21st Century. His conclusion ultimately is that this kind of inequality is a sort of inescapable fact of capitalism, right? You disagree.
That's right. So
explain.
So Piketty has tried, talks about it in terms of the natural dynamics of, you might say, capitalism. He makes a really interesting point that made me think a lot, because there's one essay in there where I talk about growing up in Gary, Indiana, which is a steel town in the southern tip of Lake Michigan. It was an iconic industrial town. It was founded in 1906. It was a real symbol of industrial America. It was the largest integrated steel mill in the world. The name of the city was named after the chairman of the board of U.S. Steel. Now, you can't be more corporate than that. When I was growing up, I saw inequality, discrimination, episodic unemployment. My classmates' parents were out of a job. So, real suffering. And Piketty says in his book, well, this was the golden age of capitalism. And I never thought that was such a golden age. But what he says is that was the period when inequality was the lowest. And actually, when you look at the statistics, he's right, that inequality had been higher, say, back in the 20s. And then there was a period of about 30, 35 years after World War II, where inequality in the United States and many other Western countries came way down. And then, beginning around 1980, late 70s, 1980, it started soaring to the level that we have today. Mm-hmm. And then that raises the question, what was unusual about that period? Was it, is this the natural state of capitalism?
Right, right.
And his hypothesis was that it was the unique circumstances of the national cohesion that fighting the war together brought in the United States and many other countries. So it was an unusual period, that he says, and clearly there was something to that. But he comes to the view that this state of inequality is the natural state of capitalism. My view is that it's really quite different. That in the 70s, we faced a number of problems. Our economy wasn't functioning very well for a number of reasons. We had high inflation, oil price shocks, and people got anxious, worried, and the idea was put forward, let's try an experiment. It was an experiment called supply-side economics. I thought, on the basis of my understanding of economics, this was going to fail. But there were a lot of people who said, we got to try something different. Right. And they said, we'll lower taxes, we'll strip away regulations that'll free up the economy, incentivize the economy, and yes, we'll wind up with more inequality, but the size of the pie will get so much bigger that even the people in the bottom or the middle will get a bigger piece of pie.
That it'll grow.
Right? They were right about one thing. Inequality did grow. Much more than they had anticipated.
I'm sorry, I missed that. That was explicitly an acknowledged.
Well, I don't think they talked about it, but look, you don't lower the tax rates at the top as much as they lowered them, and not expect there to be more inequality. I mean, so they didn't advertise that, right. But it was pretty clear that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But the supply side effects, the growth effects, never appeared. In fact, the decades after 1980, we grew much more slowly than we did the decades after World War II. Even though after World War II, we had this huge debt, 130% debt-GDP ratio, because we had to do it to fight the war. Mm-hmm. And in the period after World War II, we had shared prosperity. Every part of the economy grew, but the bottom grew more than the top, so we came together. Mm-hmm. After 1980, it was only the top that did well, and everybody else stagnated or went down. So now we've had 35 years of experiment, and I think we ought to be willing to say it was a failure.
Mm-hmm. And
now, to answer your question, what that tells me is it's not an inevitable consequence of capitalism. It's actually a perversion of capitalism. You know, when you bail out banks, you're socializing losses and privatizing gains. That's not real capitalism. Mm-hmm. So it's not capitalism. It's our policies. Mm-hmm. That's actually perverted, in many ways, the market economy.
Mm-hmm. And you're welcome to apply. I want to talk about some of those policies that have created this and some of your thoughts on policies that could take us away from it. And maybe a starting place for that, if only because I'm familiar with it, when I talk to people about the Eisenhower years and point out that the top federal income tax, marginal tax rate for income of over $400,000 was 91%, people can't believe it, really.
It's true.
Yes, right. But it's such an unthinkable number in today's politics, where we argue about 34 versus 38%. How did we get from 91 to 34? And is it possible to have a real political and economic conversation about changing that?
Well, what is interesting is a lot of the more recent economic research actually supports the view that our economy would be better if we had higher tax rates. Mm-hmm. And let me explain. I had a conversation not that long ago with the finance minister of one of the Scandinavian countries, and I asked him, why are you performing so well? You know, you're growing better than the United States. Every part of your society is participating. You have good schools, you know, a dynamic economy. How do you do it? And his answer was, we have high taxes. And of course, what he meant was it wasn't the high taxes themselves, but that you need to make a modern society function, you need to invest. You have to invest in infrastructure, education, technology, all these things. And that those things are expensive, and a well-functioning society has to pay for what it needs, and that means taxes. Mm-hmm. And this really makes a very important point of one of the themes that I raise a number of times in the book, The Great Divide, is these are matters of choice. So let's go back to the end of World War II. We were a much poorer economy. We have grown in the 70 years since World War II. And we had this huge debt from the war. And yet, at the end of the war, we said everybody who had fought in the war, which was every young man and a number of women, could get a 4-year college education for free. And they could go to the most expensive school, whatever they could get into, they could get that education for free. Now the president proposes having a 2-year, you know, community college, which are, you know, the lowest in terms of expenses, only for poor people, and people are saying we can't afford it. So what that says is not about what we can afford or not. Under Eisenhower, we put a lot of money into things like education. He responds to Sputnik, right. The highway program, and this was a Republican, believe it or not, and and he said it was important to invest in America. I mean, after all, he had fought the war to save America, and he said, look, we ought to be investing in our country. And there was a broad social consensus behind that. But that requires money. Mm-hmm. And he said we ought to share the burden fairly.
And they balanced the federal budget.
Federal budget. And what has happened now, that we call that progressive taxation, where people at the top pay more than those below, and as a percentage. Now we actually have regressive taxation. The people in the top 1/10 of 1% pay a lower tax rate than those whose income are much lower.
And how is that?
Well, the main provision, and I should point out, this is the percentage of the reported income that they pay. The main provision is the special treatment of capital gains and dividends. And the capital gains go overwhelmingly to the top 1% and disproportionately to the top 0.1%. We tax those at much lower rate than people work for a living. Mm-hmm. And to go back to your first question, you know, do you need inequality for society to function? Well, take the question of, does this lower taxation of capital gains have incentive effects that work? So the lower tax on capital gains, a lot of it has to do with capital gains on land, real estate.
Uh-huh.
Now, you asked the question, do we have more land because we tax it? As far as I can see, there's been very little increase in our land area. It has not had what we would call a supply response. And the same thing is true. You know, in fact, it was supposed to stimulate savings. After we passed this provision giving preferential treatment to capital gains, savings rate in the United States plummeted to essentially zero before the crisis. So one of the problems is that we haven't been investing in America.
And would that investment, from your perspective, both politically and economically, is that investment best extracted by a highly progressive tax system or by higher taxes for everyone? Or where do you go to get that revenue to make that kind of investment?
Well, I mean, right now, I would be very happy if we just got rid of the regressivity, mm-hmm. that we made the people at the top pay their fair share. Mm-hmm. That would be a revolution in America.
Right. So abolish the differential between capital gains and...
Abolish, right. Exactly. And then there are some little provisions that nobody knows about but benefit very few people but amount to a lot of money. There's something called the step-up of basis, which is a provision of the law that means... If you leave an asset to your child, no capital gains tax is paid on all the capital gains that accrued during your lifetime. And then if he leaves it to his child, no capital gain is paid on all the capital gain that accrues under the next generation.
Wow.
So what that means is, in effect, that the effective tax rate on capital gains is very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't even include all the tricks of putting your money in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, right. I'm assuming, right. Talk about the politics of the moment here for a minute. It's rare. You hear both Republicans and Democrats talking about income inequality now, although in somewhat different ways.
One wants to increase it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But for, well, yeah, Republicans, some of the candidates, I think, that are, as they're starting to shape up, see this as an opportunity to criticize the Obama recovery that has led to inequality, whereas Democrats want to address it sort of on the merits. Is there, within that sort of common conversation about inequality, is there room for action here? Or are we just headed for more of the same gridlock that we see in everything else?
Well, I think there is. When this discussion first began on inequality, there were some Republicans like Ryan who would say, you know, we don't care about inequality of outcomes,
right.
Inequality of income, wealth. What we care about is equality of opportunity. But then we looked at the data, and it turns out that America is not only the most unequal in income, but it's among the worst of the advanced countries in opportunity. And that's so against our view of ourselves, so against what others view of us as the land of opportunity. Let me explain what that means, because you know, everybody knows somebody who's made it from the bottom to the top, and you know, some of us did that. So everybody knows there is some opportunity, but when we talk about the extent of that opportunity, what we mean is what is the likelihood that somebody from the bottom makes it to the middle or the top? And in those terms, the life prospects of a young American are more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in other advanced countries. Or to put it in another way, in another dramatic statistic, is that a child of a rich parent who does poorly in school is going to wind up with a higher income than a child of a poor parent who winds up who does very well in school. Mm-hmm. So, as I tell my students, the most important decision you have to make in your life is choosing the right parent. once you make that mistake, you know, the game is over.
Yeah, well, right. This whole notion that mobility has really been thwarted by it is really mythology busting for the United States.
That's right. That's right.
A hard one. How is it, you've mentioned the Scandinavian countries a couple of times here, how is it that the Scandinavian countries seem to have charted such a different course on this and been not only more successful in reducing inequality, but actually more successful in mobility in some respects, right?
And just as successful in growth, or even more successful.
Right.
They just successful seem like in growth sort of and managing the recent crisis, for instance. Well, I think there is an understanding there that there is a sense of community, mm-hmm. you know, that we used to have that notion when Kennedy was the president. He famously said, "A rising tide lifts all boats." Mm-hmm. So his vision was that we were a community, and when one boat did better, everybody, you know, it would all move together. That's not been America the last 35 years. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense that the yachts are doing very well, and the dinghies are being crashed by the by the waves created by the big yachts. Yeah. So I think there is a sense of community that is really important. One aspect and maybe I should say one other thing. There's also a strong commitment to democracy. And so when they think about, say, the question of globalization, they say, look, we are a small country, we have to open ourselves up. But if we do it in the wrong way, people are going to be slammed down. In our democracy, we can't afford that. Mm-hmm. They will vote against it. I mean, they've tried to create a democracy where the voices of everybody are heard. Mm-hmm. So they said, we have to create a economy and a society so that everybody has to benefit as we open up, as we globalize, as we introduce new technology. Mm-hmm. And so they realize that if you believe in democracy, you really have to work to have this shared prosperity that we had under Eisenhower and that we had in the decades after World War II.
There's a statement in the book, I think it's from your Vanity Fair piece, where you talk about gridlock in Washington, again, to the politics of this, actually working to the advantage of the 1%. I'll just read it here. It says, the top 1% may complain about the kind of government we have in America, but in truth, they like it just fine. Too gridlock to redistribute, too divided to do anything but lower taxes. That's a pretty startling indictment. I mean, and it suggests a sort of consciousness on this part, too, that the 1% are actively working to gridlock Washington as opposed to merely benefiting by it. Is that your take on it?
Yeah, well, the title of that essay was Of the 1%, For the 1%, right. And By the 1%.
It's memorable.
And that said a lot. And as you know, it's a paraphrase of Lincoln, Gettysburg Address. I write these essays to try to bring the introductory material, to bring the essays up to date and to put them into context. One of the observation I made was I was one at an interesting dinner party on the east side in New York. There's a big divide between the east of Central Park and the west of Central Park. It's part of the Great Divide. And every once in a while, I do make it across. It was one of those very, very well-off person was very, very bright and very, very concerned about inequality. And she had brought together a group of people, including some of the very conservative billionaires. And so it was a really interesting evening. And several times during the evening, several of these people who had inherited money in the billions, so these are not your typical millionaires, these are the billionaires, were saying, we have to remember the guillotine.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, it was really, it came up more than once, and it was sort of like, we have to be aware that we can't be too selfish. And, you know, they were too selfish back then, and it wasn't a sense of social responsibility. It was
sounds
a sense
like self-protection.
it was a sense of self-protection, you know. And you know, we get a glimmer of that when we have the riots in Baltimore, like today, mm-hmm. that we can, you know, when you squeeze down too hard, things bubble up.
Mm-hmm. And do you think we're getting to that place?
Well, no, we're not. You know, we've been very hard pressed on certain minorities. So we know that. We've seen that in Ferguson and Baltimore. So yes, on those groups, absolutely we have, but so far not on the most of the 99%.
Right, right. I said at the outset, wanted to talk about some of the ramifications for inequality, mobility, public health, environment, democracy, all of which you go into considerable detail in here. I know that's a lot to chew on, but talk about some of the ways in which inequality is really affecting other aspects of our lives in ways that people might not even be aware of.
Well, actually, one of the striking things is even for people who have good insurance, Americans are less healthy than people in other countries. And that's a real mystery. I mean, people have tried to, you know, I go up to the, Columbia has a good medical school, good public health, and we've had a lot, you know, discussions about it. And one interpretation is that when you live in a very divided society, there's a lot of stress. Huh. There's a lot of stress because it's very hard to get to the top, but even more, you know, and you want to make sure your children make it to the top, that's stressful. But even more, you realize that if you don't stay there, there's a long way to fall down. And all of that stress shows up in health. Huh. And so it's really quite striking that people of comparable income, you know, the average health in the United States is much poorer than in other countries that spend a much less on health care. We live 3 years shorter than in Australia, and they spend 8% of their GDP on health care. We spend 17%.
Wow.
But what is so striking is that, you know, you look income by income category, and the well-off who have insurance, it's not a lack of access. It is just the stress of being in a divided society.
And there are not other factors, I would have thought.
There are other factors, but even many of those people know about smoking, they know about, you know, so they know about the other aspects of a healthy lifestyle. Stress.
And having to keep the guillotine ready.
That's right.
And talk about one of the aspects of the book that I was most taken with is your discussion of inequality and its effects on democracy. We're experiencing some of this in Citizens United and contributions and whatnot. Talk a little bit about how...
Well, the bottom line that I come to is that America is moving closer to a society of one person, $1, one vote, than one person, one vote. And that obviously has very strong implications for the way our society and our democracy functions. You know, it's not a surprise when you have a lot of economic inequality, as much as we have, that gets translated into political inequality, especially when you have a country where money plays such an important role in the political process. The last election, each of the candidates spent over $1 billion. People are expecting the 2016 election to be much more expensive. Right. The banks and the others who made campaign contributions, the word contributions is a euphemism. It was an investment.
Right.
And the banks got a lot better return out of that investment than they did out of their financial investments that were a disaster.
Right.
But they got the bailouts, they got the deregulation. They now were able to push off the increase in the kind of regulations that we needed. Mm-hmm. Dodd-Frank was a compromise. And even after Dodd-Frank was passed, I don't know if you noticed last December, they started repealing mm-hmm. the provisions of Dodd-Frank, even before it got through the regulatory process.
Right.
So not a surprise that given this level of economic inequality, that we wind up with this kind of political inequality. What I said is it undermines our democracy. You know, we talk how important it is, our democracy. American voter turnout is one of the worst in the world. Why? People have become disillusioned. They say whoever wins, it's going to be the money that talks. So why? How does it pay to vote? I mean, I still think it pays a lot because there still is hope that we can change things. And as we're seeing, for instance, you know, we didn't talk about the bottom. But, you know, the minimum wage in the United States is lower than it was roughly 45 years ago, adjusted for inflation. I mean, can you imagine? Mm-hmm. No pay raise for almost a half century.
Right.
70% of Americans think there should be an increase in the minimum wage. We can obviously afford it. Mm-hmm. But Congress won't pass it.
Right.
So there's big Democratic movements going on in a number of cities around the United States doing that. So that gives me a little hope.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I was going to ask you about that because this is one of those cities. There is a proposal the mayor has made to raise the minimum wage for the city. I was curious your sense of the relative merits of a minimum wage that is so geographically constrained. Is it worth it? Does it chase away jobs? Does it? What are the ramifications?
No, the minimum wage is so low currently, and the proposals are going to still keep it. Relatively
here,
low.
I think it would go to
half. Our minimum wage is less than half of that of Australia.
Is that right?
Instincts. I think it won't chase away mm-hmm. jobs. Evidence is that, in fact, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, did a study of the effects of minimum wage. No significant adverse employment effects. Used to be that the people working at the minimum wage were teenage kids after school. No longer. Now, disproportionately, they're single. You know, people who are supporting a whole family.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you can't live on $15,000 a year in Los Angeles.
Right.
Certainly, I know you can't in New York.
Right. Right. No, you can't here either. And so you would make that. You would apply the same argument though to a not just to a national minimum wage, but to a local minimum wage as well.
That's right. That's right. I mean, obviously. You can't be totally insensitive of what's going on. But one of the early studies looked at what happens if one state raises their minimum wage and the other doesn't. They're right next to each other, New mm-hmm. Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
And that's where the study showed no adverse effect on employment. So they could do it, you know, see right across the border. And that was where the clearest test of the hypothesis was done.
I'm going to come to you all in just a minute, so be ready. We'll get microphones ready. But before we do, I just wanted to ask you one question that's really more to your previous book than this one. But when we last were here, still very much in the throes of the recession, you were very critical of the Obama administration and particularly some members of the administration for what you regarded as a far too conservative approach to responding to the recession. Now things look somewhat better, I think you'd agree, right? I guess I'm curious whether you're still as critical as you were or whether you believe this recession would have passed more swiftly and with better results had they tackled it in a different way.
Do I think that if they listened to me more, things would be better?
I wasn't going to ask that directly, but yes.
Okay, obviously the answer is yes. they believed very much like the Reagan administration believed in trickle-down economics. You throw enough money at the banks, and all of us will get better.
Mm-hmm.
I argue they should try some trickle-up economics. Help homeowners. Help homeowners who are losing their homes. And that would mean there would be fewer defaults, fewer foreclosures. That would be another way of helping the banks. Mm-hmm. But when we threw money at the banks in the way the Obama administration, the Bush administration did, they used some of that money for paying out big bonuses, for paying out dividends. We didn't even, you know, when Obama went to the American people, he said, we need to give the money to the banks in order for them to keep lending going.
Right.
Okay, the lifeblood of
keep
the economy.
Keep them afloat, right?
But they didn't put any condition on the money they were giving the banks. You know, when I was at the World Bank, when we gave money to a country, we said, if you get this money, this is what you have to do with it. Okay, you can't spend it on military. You can't, you know, you have to use it to develop your economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes we put too many conditions, but we always, the view was, if you're giving taxpayer money, you got to show that there are good results. Mm-hmm. We didn't put any conditions. And the result of that was, years after the banks got the money, lending to small and medium-sized enterprises was 20% below what it was before the crisis. Mm-hmm. No wonder we didn't have a strong recovery. Mm-hmm. No wonder the way the recovery worked, in the first 3 years of the recovery, 91% of the growth went to the top 1%. That's not a recovery.
Right.
So there were other ways of doing things that would have worked for more Americans and would have led to a stronger recovery.
Mm-hmm. Should the administration have let some of the bigger banks fail, or AG for that matter?
The question wasn't letting the banks fail. That would have been disrupting. Mm-hmm. The question is, should you have let the shareholders, the bondholders, and the bankers pay for their mismanagement? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me pretty obvious that you should have. That was the rule of capitalism. And the argument was they were getting so super salaries, mm-hmm. super bonuses for doing a good job. Well, if you get bonuses for doing a good job, you ought to pay the penalty for doing a bad job. And it was very transparent that they were doing a bad job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the problem was they didn't play by the rules of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of midstream, they changed the rules because they were working against them. And that raises really a critical point that I make in this book, The Great Divide. The inequality that we have is a result, as I say, of our policies. But those policies have, in a way, structured the economy in ways that work for that 1% mm-hmm. and against most of us. To give you another example that illustrates how things have gone awry. In the last 35 years, say, productivity of American workers has doubled. Wages have stagnated. Historically, whenever productivity increases, wages go in tandem. If productivity goes up more, wages go up more. You know, if you look across countries, that's the pattern. But again, it's part of American exceptionalism in the last 30 years. Productivity growth does not mean wage growth. And that's because of the way we structured our economy. And there are new changes that are threatening to make it even worse. The new trade agreement, the TPP, that the president is pushing, I think it will make things even worse. So these are the subtle ways in which we change the rules without any real democratic discussion. And they keep changing them, you know, time after time after time in ways that tilt the playing field for the 1% and against.
And those who are making that policy happen to be in the 1%.
Exactly.
Reinforcing quality.
And they don't want to even have an open discussion about the process of rulemaking. They won't even disclose to the American people what the U.S. trade representative is negotiating. You know, they refuse to disclose the negotiating position except to the corporations who are working together to frame that negotiating position. But if you and I want to find out, it's labeled secret.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a cheery note. so how about all of you? Who's got some questions? You want to? We have a microphone, and the admonitions are don't make a speech and wait for the microphone. So
first question, right?
Please.
Great, thank you. Hi, welcome to Los Angeles. As you know, there's been a lot of buzz about Elizabeth Warren and a lot of people calling for her to run for president, even though she's made it quite clear that she has no interest in doing so. I see that as a ray of hope in that the buzz surrounding her might push Hillary to support more progressive economic policies and thus generate some real enthusiasm and get some of those voters who are currently disaffected, as you mentioned, to start thinking that there is a reason to come out and vote. So my question is, do you think that that is helpful, or do you think that's just going to change Hillary's rhetoric but not her policies?
No, I do think it's helpful. I think it's particularly helpful because Elizabeth Warren is in a critical position in the Senate. Her committee has to approve anybody who is nominated for the Secretary of Treasury. And anybody who is running for the president knows that. They know that very clearly. And she, Sherrod Brown, have been very successful in using that position. For instance, one of the essays in my book, Great Divide, talks about the big battle that we had for who should be the chairman of the Federal Reserve. There was President Obama, you know, historically it's the president who gets to choose. But the view of some of us was that if the president makes a mistake, it shouldn't be his decision. So he wanted to appoint one of the great deregulators, one of the people that was responsible for the deregulation, passing a law that says that we could not regulate derivatives. And of course, derivatives were what led to the AIG collapse, that led to the $180 billion bailout of AIG, more money than we paid for welfare for the ordinary Americans for a decade. We went to one company. So for some reason, Obama wanted him to be in charge of our financial system after he brought our financial system to a collapse. And many of us thought that that did not show good judgment. So, and there was a fantastic woman who happened to be my student, Janet Yellen. Mm-hmm. And so I knew how good, how bright she was, and she had the best forecasting record in terms of where the economy was going. And she had an additional feature that she actually worried about unemployment and people who lost their jobs rather than just Wall Street. And so there was concerted action by the Senate Banking Committee and a large number of other progressive Americans, and it succeeded. And that's why we have Janet Yellen, and that's why we now have much more focus on unemployment. And you have the chairman of the Fed saying that that inequality is an important issue, and that the Fed policy does have effects on inequality. And so, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, they had me give, I went to the Fed, and I gave a lecture on the very many ways in which Fed policy affects inequality, some of which I talk about in the book. So, and that's, by the way, another example of how our whole economic structure affects inequality. It's not just an accident. It's the way we run our whole economic system.
Sure.
So this might not be your expertise, but do you think there's a pathological lack of empathy as far as, you know, those who are making, you know, the big decisions in those secret meetings you're referring to?
Yes. And you know, it's one of the things that's concerned me a great deal about how we frame policymaking. That quite often you're in these committees, and everything gets converted into statistics. And it's a little bit like people who bomb other countries from 50,000 feet. You don't see the destruction that happens when those bombs hit the ground. And the same thing, when you're just looking at the unemployment statistics, they're just a number. And they're not people. People who are losing their job, people whose children can't go to college. you know, it doesn't take a lot of empathy to figure that out, but there is a problem with a lot of the people. It may be some of them suffer from Asperger's.
Next question. Well, I'm heartened to hear the role that you played in getting Yellen in, but I'm wondering whether you think that was a failure in the past of economists to really intervene and with Obama, that and what can be done. You know, will there be more concerted efforts like that in the future? And what can economists do to bring out more empathy in the public in general? Is there a way of your putting or your putting a face on these things?
Well, one of the ways that economists, I think, have changed, a few economists have changed the debate about inequality, is to highlight the fact that when inequality grows too big, and in the United States has grown too big, it actually harms the economy. And this was a view that I had for a long while, but now this has become a mainstream view. The IMF, which is not known to be an exactly left-wing organization, International Monetary Fund, has for the last few years been going around the world telling governments, you have to pay attention to the extremes of inequality. You know, I'd been there when the Madame Lagarde, who is the head of the IMF, told the Chinese, you know, inequality has gotten too large, you got to do something about it. So when you have people, economists like that, and you have people who are really saying, you know, forget about the moral issue, the issues of empathy and all that. If you're only selfish, you ought to be worried about it. And that has helped a little bit.
You've talked a lot about the 1% and where all the money is going. But what you haven't talked about is the 50% that seem to support the 1% that leads to gridlock in Washington. And to a large extent, I wonder if that isn't driven by a total inability to discern self-interest. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Actually, I just want to make clear, when I use the 1%, it's a metaphor for the people at the top. It's not a, you know, and many people in the 1% actually agree that inequality has gotten too large. They've been supporting political action to stop the growth of inequality. They've been donating huge amounts of money. So I want to make it clear that it's not a blanket condemnation. If you ask most Americans about most of the policies that are at stake, most of them would agree with the views that I've expressed. What happens, though, is that somehow, in the political process, there's a large amount of disillusionment. And we also have to realize that if you can sell cigarettes, which kill people, and persuade people that cigarettes are safe, which the cigarette companies have done, you can sell bad ideas. And the 1% have the resources, the incentives, and the knowledge of how to manipulate public opinion. So that's why I think it's really important to have the counter story and try to explain why it's not in their interest. I mean, there are some real examples, though, where they've been so successful in selling ideas that are really against their own interests. Let me just give you one, and that is the estate and inheritance tax. Very few people pay that tax. Now in the United States, you basically, a married couple has to have an estate of over $10 million. And yet most Americans actually supported the repeal of the inheritance tax. Now you ask, you know, I wish it were a problem that they had to face. But most of them have no estate to leave to speak of. You know, they could all pray about winning the lottery, But even most lotteries are not going to give them $10 million. So it's all a fantasy. And that is, to me, a quintessential example of how people have been distorted and realize that, you know, the reason I mention it, it is through the estate tax that we prevent the buildup of an inherited plutocracy. And that inherited plutocracy really can really destroy what we have as a country. Just to give you one number that illustrates this, there are 8 Americans from 2 families, you can figure out who the 2 families are, that inherited their money, that have as much wealth as the bottom 44% of America, which is testimony to how much inequality there is at the top, inherited inequality, and how much poverty, you know, how poor things are at the bottom.
And just to underscore that point, you know, for all the talk we've had of income inequality, wealth inequality is really much worse than...
It's much worse. That's why these are wealth numbers.
Right.
These are wealth numbers.
Right.
Next question. Professor Stiglitz, could you... Federal Reserve has had interest rates have been basically zero in nominal terms and negative in real terms. Could you talk a little bit about the impact on middle-income retired folks in terms of income that's been basically evaporated by low interest rates and a normalization of rates and the offset in terms of employment?
Yeah, that's a good point. And it was one of the issues that I raised when I came to the Fed and talked about how they had contributed to inequality, not always intentionally. The problem that the Fed faces is they see a weak economy, and I think they're right about that. They also recognize, I think, at least most of them, that the underlying problem is lack of demand. The best way of getting supported demand is through fiscal policy. We can borrow as a country at a negative real interest rate, as you said. We have huge needs in infrastructure. I mean, anybody who comes into Kennedy Airport knows what I'm talking about. We have bridges that are falling. We need more investment in infrastructure, in technology. You know, we have huge needs for investment. And if a firm could borrow at a minus 2% and have projects that yield returns literally of 15, 20%, you would be stupid not to do it. And yet we're not doing that. So that's what we ought to be doing, but we're not. And that these investments would actually bring the country together and create a more equal society. So the Fed is put in a quandary. It says the fiscal policy, the federal government's not doing what it should be doing. The only thing that we're the only game in town. So we only have a limited number of instruments. One of the instruments is lower interest rates. To the extent that those lower interest rates stimulate demand, and they do have a little bit effect on that, they increase employment, and that's very important for inequality. Unemployment is really bad for inequality for 3 reasons. One, if you don't have a job, your income gets very low. 2, the greater unemployment is really negative, drives down wages in general, one of the reasons wages have done so badly. And thirdly, the lower economic performance means that revenues at the state level get cut back and basic services get cut back at the state and local level. So that's what they focused on. But the flip side of the coin is as they lower the interest rate, they have a devastating effect on those older people who act prudently, who put their money in T-bills and government bonds, and their incomes have just been wiped out. And they've caused poverty. Meanwhile, QE, what is the basis of QE? Quantitative easing is designed to increase stock prices. So those who are at the top of the pyramid have their stock doing very well. So they've increased wealth inequality. So this is a real example of how the Fed has had this big increase in inequality. Now, I do fault them for not doing more of what they should have done. 2 things that they should have done. One of the reasons that the Fed policy did not stimulate the economy as much as it could have is that the credit channel is broken. When we bailed out the big banks, we didn't help the small local community banks that are disproportionately engaged in small and medium-sized enterprise. That was why, and we didn't put conditions on the banks that they lend, and that's why small and medium-sized lending was so down, and one of the reasons that the economy didn't do well. Secondly, when the administration and the Fed went to save the banks, it saved it in part by encouraging them to merge. We already had, following the repeal of the Glass-Steagall, a uncompetitive lack of competition in the banking system. We reduced competition. We increased market power in the banking system. What did that mean? That meant that when the interest rates got lowered, the benefits weren't passed on to the ultimate consumer. They weren't passed on to people trying to get mortgages. It went to enrich the coffers of the banks. If we had had more competition, a really competitive banking system, consumers would have benefited. We would have had more lending. So the bottom line is they have a responsibility of making our financial system work. Just like before the crisis, they didn't pay attention to it and they let the financial system explode. After the crisis, they paid too little attention to making sure we had a well-functioning financial system. So I do fault them in that way. But they should have made a lot more noise saying, really, we need fiscal policy. Monetary policy has reached its limits.
Speaking of the guillotine, what's your view of the administration's failure to prosecute any of the big bankers? And what might we do about that to restore some of fairness to the criminal justice system?
Well, he's written a book with a title. What was the subtitle of your book about Earl Warren?
Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made.
Justice for All. and you know, in our Pledge of Allegiance, we say, Pledge of Allegiance, you know, justice for all. Right. We've now modified that right. to justice for those who can afford it. Mm-hmm. And no justice for those who are very rich. And the point is that we have not held the bankers accountable. I mean, you're absolutely right. Meanwhile, we threw out of their homes many people who didn't owe anything. The bankers signed affidavits that they had examined that people owed the money, and that's why they were being thrown out of their homes. They had done no such thing. They had this Robux signing. Thousands and thousands of commissions of perjury signing affidavits. No one was held accountable. So that's a perversion of justice. We were talking about all the ways in which inequality, all the forms of inequality in our society, inequality of health. One of the real issues, I think, is inequality of justice. And, you know, African Americans understand that. They've lived it. And we've seen it, what's going on. But it's true across the board. And it's, you know, justice for those who do the kinds of things that the bankers did. In the SNL crisis, a lot of people were held accountable. But 20 years on, that's not part of the American system today. But meanwhile, people at the bottom don't get a fair shake.
Okay, very good.
Thank you for an incredible event. One of the things that we've been talking about is we keep talking about the bottom, and we're referring specifically to a class thing, and class is the one element of our identities that can change. So how can we then build solidarity around a part of ourselves that is so or in theory is in flux, as opposed to things like race and sexuality? How do we build solidarity around class?
Yeah, one of the reasons why I wrote my original article in Vanity Fair was that, you know, and I talked about, you know, the 1% and the 99%, because I wanted to make Americans understand it isn't really anymore a class thing. It's not the bottom and the middle, and it's essentially all of us, except for a very few. And that is the big change. We all used to be together in what might be called the middle class. But that middle class has been, the middle class life has been destroyed. It's increasingly difficult to attain the basic conditions of a middle class lifestyle, the kind of secure retirement that, you know, that you were talking about, making sure that your kids can get the college education that would allow them to live up to the potential without being burdened by $25,000 or $100,000 of debt. Home ownership, staying in your home without losing your home. You know, what we used to think of as the basic necessities of a middle class lifestyle are increasingly out of reach. And as we recognize that, that's a shared experience that we all have. And so that's why I use the vocabulary of the 99%. It was a metaphor again. But to tell, you know, this is not a class thing. You know, it's not like in the UK where there are class divisions. America is really a classless society in that sense, a middle-class society. But it's unfortunately a society in which there is this great divide that has divided a few from the rest, and you know that few have seized a larger and larger and larger share of the economic pie, the result of which is the whole pie is getting not growing the way it should, and most of us are seeing a smaller and smaller piece.
One more, I guess, right? Over here.
Going back to the metaphor of the guillotine as a metaphor, which seemed to resonate in the room, I'll use it as a metaphor for militancy. And it seems like the labor unions had militancy that built the middle class and got us into the 50s. In your analysis, where do you see the lever that people can actually hold on to and pull to generate that kind of militancy for their own welfare if it's not trade unions, which maybe it is and maybe it's not? How do you see that militancy possibly coming about?
Well, support for trade unions, you know, is one aspect, but a broader support for civil society action. So, for instance, right now the country is having, or ought to be having, a big debate about TPP and the Trade Promotion Authority. This is an example of a change of the way our government, of our economy works. This trade TPP is designed to make it more difficult to regulate the environment, health, safety, even the financial sector. You know, I jokingly say that no one has told the U.S. trade representative that we had a crisis in 2008. I've been trying to get a message to them. And that one of the lessons, actually, I did tell them this, but they didn't hear, that there is a widespread recognition that we need to strengthen financial regulation. But this agreement would make it difficult, if not impossible, to increase financial regulation, because there's a provision that says any change in regulation that adversely affects profits, you have to compensate those who lose their expectational profits, what they expected to get. And what I'm talking about is not just a matter of speculation. These kinds of provisions have already been put in place in a number of agreements. And there are suits going on all over the world. Let me just tell you one that I find particularly pernicious. And it echoes a theme that I've already talked about, cigarettes. Many of you may know about the Opium War. It was one of the first trade opening issues where there was a trade imbalance. We didn't really, you know, you talk about trade imbalances more recently, but there's a trade imbalance in the 19th century. The trade imbalance was that China had lots of things that the West wanted, including China, porcelain. And so they were exporting to the West a lot, but the West, but the West had nothing that China wanted. And that caused a great imbalance until the West, the UK in particular, figured out a solution. Opium. That opium is a great product, as we tell our business students, because a great product has repeat purchase, customer loyalty. And with opium, you get a lot of customer loyalty. Mm. You keep coming back. But the Chinese government said, figured out after a while, this wasn't very good for China. It was really, really bad. So they said, no more opium. And the West said, that's interfering with free trade. And the West went to war twice. And they were called the Opium Wars. I mean, can you believe it? We went to war to make sure the basic human right, that we have the right to kill people in China through the sale of opium. Now, the USTR, the US government, your government, is waging what is I call the 21st century opium war. It's not about opium, it's about cigarettes. But the view is that it is a basic right of American companies to sell cigarettes to kill people. And any country that tries to stop that is interfering with free trade and is a violation of our basic rights. So Philip Morris is now suing Uruguay and Australia. What is it that they've done that's so terrible? They actually have passed laws that say you have to label cigarettes packages as dangerous for your health. Can you believe that? And in the case of Australia, they do it a little bit more graphically. I don't know if you go to Australia, no. They actually show you what the lungs look like. It's pretty, pretty ugly. Philip Morris says this is discouraging people from buying cigarettes. Yes, that was the intent. And the good news is that it's working. But Philip Morris says that's taking away our profits. And under this investment agreement, under these trade agreements, you can't do that. And if you do that, you have to pay us not to kill your citizens. And this is what Obama is trying to get passed.
So why is he doing that?
Is it surprising we've been talking about the role of money in politics? That's it. It's the role of money. And it's pretty disgusting. So this is a dramatic case, but we're talking about environmental regulations. We're talking about safety regulations. We're talking about the judicial system. You know, one of the basic, you know, you're talking about justice for all. One of the guarantees of justice for all is public courts. We have a public judicial system. They want all of these cases to be adjudicated by private panels of privately paid arbitrators, corporate lawyers. They're corporate lawyers, and charging huge amounts of money so that poor countries can't defend themselves. So in the case of Uruguay, they can't defend themselves. So you know what? Who's paying for Uruguay's defense? Mayor Bloomberg. So Americans are paying to defend Americans' assault against the health of Uruguay.
That's
now, you know, I give Bloomberg an awful lot of credit. You know, he says he believes that cigarettes are bad, and he's trying to get health regulations in New York that reflect this. And he says, you know, what's good enough for New York is good enough for other countries. And we can't do that. It's immoral. And at least he's helping Uruguay. But Obama is trying to make sure that all these other countries are exposed to exactly that kind of risk. And I think it's immoral. I think it's unconscionable. And so you, to answer the question is, you ought to get outraged. And you ought to try to do something about it.
Well, on that note, let me just say, someone asked earlier. The question was earlier, what can economists do to change these things? Well, one of the things they could do is more of them could write books with this kind of power and this kind of insight. And so we thank you very much for being here. And thank you for coming. And
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.